Sydney Purcell comes from a long line of Indigenous people on her dad's side. But growing up in Kansas City, surrounded by white American culture, images of Pocahontas formed her early idea of what an Indian girl should look like. Fast forward to adulthood, Sydney's an artist, and her art has brought her closer to her own identity. She's learning the Bahoje language of her tribe. She's working in that language. But far from avoiding the stereotypes that misled her growing up, she's taken them on. Sydney is one of the first participants in the Indigenous Arts Initiative in Kansas, and we're going to hear what she's working on now on KCUR's Central Standard. Sydney Purcell, good morning.
Aha, thank you.
I was looking through the work on your website, and I saw this video that basically goes really fast through every Indian costume with a white background that comes up on a Google search. It is insane. Can you explain what I'm seeing?
Yes, that is a video which is exactly that. The title of it is Every Indian Costume with a White Background Found on a Google Image Search. And for that piece, I literally just Googled Indian costume and took every single piece that I found in the Google image search and then put it in a video where they flip extremely fast. And through that video, you can see just how much tan fabric and fringe and feathers is involved in these costumes and really make up those stereotypes.
Like, there are a lot of lingerie ones.
Oh, there's a ton of those that must be, yeah, some sort of strange fetish.
But you put, you made it so that the body of the costume wearer was always really in the same place. So it's like the costume is the character.
Yeah, for sure. And it's those representations that really I'm trying to fight, especially this sexy Indian stereotype that has contributed to the high rates of missing and murdered indigenous women in Native communities. So that's one thing that I'm very passionate about eradicating.
You did a project last year where you set up a teepee outside a library and you put a combination of quote unquote authentic Indian objects and fake ones on the inside. Can you explain that project and talk a little bit about what you were doing there?
Yes, this is a project that I got when I was a McNair Scholar at the University of Missouri, actually. It's been traveling around the United States since 2011, I believe, is when I started it. And I had amassed this giant collection of Indian objects because it was something that I was interested in. And people would give them to me constantly. And I decided...
What kinds of things are you talking about?
Oh, yes. I think I'm trying... For that project, I was trying to get people to have one-on-one discussions with me about issues of identity and representation.
Like when they sauntered into the teepee.
Yes. So I asked them if they could identify the authentic Indian items within all of this Indian junk. So it gave them an entry point, and I could see how much they knew about Indian culture. So it was a kind of starting point.
But I am curious to hear descriptions of the junk.
Oh, it's a lot of made in China objects, Indian costumes, Indian face paint, Pocahontas dolls, cowboy and Indian toys. There's Native American mascots from different sports teams, lots and lots of dream catchers that were made in China.
Yeah. What kinds of conversations did you end up having?
It's interesting because you talk with children about identifying the authentic items within it, and they have a hard time coming up with a starting point. But then you have older children that can right away identify that these moccasins are handmade versus something that's in a package. So it's a way to also start talking to people about the Indian Arts and Crafts Act, where there's actual tags on authentic Indian items that were made by Indian people. So if you're going to a gas station and you see a bunch of dream catchers, if there is a tag on it that says this is not made by a Native American, it's an easy way to identify whether you're supporting Native communities or just supporting these stereotypes and taking away from people that do make their living off of making Native artistry.
You've also done some work with an object that you found at a thrift store. This is your Medicine Man project?
Yes. This is a project that I made when I heard about these sweat lodges that were happening. They were being put on by white people that had little connection to Native cultures, and they were charging people for these sweat lodge ceremonies, and people started dying. So it was a comment
from sweating too much.
From sweating too much, yes. From doing the sweats improperly. They were doing them in, like, plastic instead of a fabric that can breathe and things like that. So people were actually dying from this neo-shamanistic practice. So this piece was kind of inspired by that. I had found this neon glowing Indian at a thrift store. It has a fiber optic headdress and this glowing, like, ball that sits on top of a wolf, and it was kind of insane. So I purchased it and made a box around it, got a sticker machine, and on the box I wrote Infinite Wisdom, Medicine Man. So you physically bow down to the sticker part of the machine and put your quarter in, and out comes the little cardboard folder, but inside your infinite wisdom is actually a fortune cookie fortune. And it's kind of like a joke on the viewer as well. Like, what did you actually expect this neon glowing Indian to give you? As well as a comment on the disconnection between the authentic and the non-authentic. So a lot of people may not know that Chinese fortune cookies were not made in China. They actually originated in California, I believe. So there's that connection that I was playing with as well.
Just the idea that there are many cultures that get sort of transformed this way.
Correct.
You know, the idea, I mean, as I sort of listened to you talking about your work and as I was looking through your website, I was thinking about the idea that if we don't have contact with Native communities, then our ideas of what American Indians are, who American Indians are, comes from these cultural artifacts that may or may not have anything to do with Native culture in reality. But also that even if we re-educate ourselves, these messages still live somewhere in our brains.
Yes, and they still live in mine every day as well. It's something that I struggle with, being Native but not looking Native, because even though my grandma had really good intentions when I was younger, like I was obsessed with Pocahontas. She would give me Indian dolls for my birthday every year. I started realizing that I didn't look like those Indian dolls. So there was something wrong with me, even though I had a tribal ID and I knew a little bit about my culture, and we would go back to the reservation often. It was still something that I still struggle with every day.
Is carrying those messages.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about your childhood. I referenced your childhood in Kansas City and that you were surrounded in that childhood by white American culture, but can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I grew up in Kansas City with my mother, and my nativeness was on my father's side. My mom's from a very large Irish Catholic family in Kansas City, so I grew up surrounded by that culture a lot more than my native side. But we would also go with my grandparents all the time, and we would go up to the reservation at least once a year for our annual tribal powwow and fall encampment. So I had a connection to that culture. But I still felt removed for it, or like I didn't quite belong. So it took until college where I really started relearning American history and why I was felt removed from that culture. And
what is your can you pinpoint a moment in a lesson where you were like, wait a second?
It was through my art classes, I believe. I was just doing a lot of research about early American history and learning about treaties, which is not something that I learned about in elementary or, you know, my secondary education. So learning about treaties, learning about the true story of Columbus, like it was terrible and we don't hear that story when we're growing up. Learning about removal and learning about the own separation of my tribe. So when our tribe separated,
do you mind if I jump in and ask what is your tribe? You've made reference to going to the reservation, and I'm curious about where that is, what it is.
So I am a member of the Iowa tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, which really identifies all of the complexities. We are the Iowa tribe. It is what the state of Iowa is named after. We call ourselves Bahoje. And then through relocation and these treaties, we were moved to Missouri, and then the Platte Purchase happened, so they moved us to Kansas and Nebraska.
And you learned this for the first time as a college student doing research for art projects?
Yes, that is correct.
Can I just acknowledge that that must have been a very strange emotional experience for you? I mean, I picture someone sitting alone with a book learning this traumatic piece of what is personal history for you.
Yeah, it is strange. And it's weird to, like, learn a culture through a book, but I part of me definitely has that experience. While I have gone back home, you know, to the reservation where my grandfather grew up, and I've heard his stories, and I've been involved in the culture a little bit. Before my grandmother passed away, she showed me how to dance in our traditional way. But then also learning so much of the history through books and tribal websites and different information that other tribal scholars have done before me was very informative.
What was it that had inspired you to pursue your own history through these art projects to begin with? You could have gone as an art student into, you know, doing a project about the sunset, or what was it that drew you in that direction?
Well, I had this tribal ID, and it wasn't until, like, it was always just like a show and tell thing, like, hey, look at this, I'm an Indian, kind of when I was in elementary school. But then in college, when I got a diversity award scholarship, I really started questioning, like, what is this tribal ID? What do I have it? What am I supposed to do with it? What are these responsibilities? And that's what started the thought process and really diving into what does it mean to be Native, and am I Indian enough, which is another art project that I have.
You know, there's a project that we haven't talked about yet. It's what you've called your stop sign project. And that involves, it's not an art project in the short-term kind of project sense. It begins with you attempting to learn a language.
That is correct. So when I went to graduate school, I was living in Columbia, Missouri, and I moved to Lawrence, Kansas, which was much closer to the reservation than I had lived before. So I was able to go up to the Bahoje Woskachi, which is our Iowa Museum and Cultural Center on the reservation, and our Tribal Historic Preservation Officer was doing language learning classes. So I was able to go up once a week and meet with this group of people that were learning the language together. And our group started pretty decent sized. It was maybe 8 people, 8 to 10 every week. And then as the weather hit, people started dropping off because they weren't able to travel there as often.
I love that it's just the weather that hit. Yeah. Not even a specific kind of weather, just then weather happened.
The first week, you know, 2 people less. The second week, a couple more less. And then, yeah. Winter, no one wants to travel all the way up there, and the roads are not the best. So eventually it was just 2 of us, and then we kind of fizzled away as well. So I was kind of upset because I had finally moved really close, and I wanted to, like, do these language learning classes. I wanted to learn, but I was frustrated because not many other people wanted to. So I applied for a grant to do a stop sign project on the reservation. My thought process was maybe if the language was more visible, maybe if people could see it more, they would be more interested in learning it. So I made a series of signs, including stop signs. I had street signs, signs for different streams that were on the reservation and the river.
Written in the Bahoje language?
In the Bahoje language, correct.
And had you already learned enough of the language to do that, or was that sort of a project in and of itself?
It was a project in and of itself. So there are resources available for the language. There is an online dictionary that was completed in 2012 by a linguist named Jim Goodtracks. And then there were different YouTube videos that you could watch that would go through some of these old study guides from the 70s when they were working on the language a lot back then. So there are different resources that were available to be used. So I was using some of those and working with some of the language experts and the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer.
So it is interesting to me that you tried to teach not just yourself, but other people the language by moving it outside the classroom. And it strikes me that a language that exists only in a classroom isn't a living, breathing language. It's like you were trying to, like, do CPR.
Yeah, and that's the problem with a lot of languages. Technically, our language is dead. There are zero fluent speakers of the language, so there's only a couple experts that know the most about it, but no one is actually speaking it actively. So it's a lot of work to try to bring it back to life, to resuscitate it. And it's a difficult journey.
We'll continue our conversation with Sydney Purcell in just a minute. She's an artist who's reconnecting with her own history and identity through art. Coming up, we'll hear about the new Indigenous Arts Initiative she's a part of, what it means to be an Indigenous artist. Is that a role that comes with certain responsibilities? And if so, does there need to be a particular kind of support to make it all possible? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking with artist Sydney Purcell about her life and her art. And Sydney, we were just talking about your stop sign project, and you were saying that it has been hard for you to be seeing what's happened with the Bahoje language and to be, as I was saying, you know, performing CPR essentially.
Yes. It's a very difficult journey because there's not very many people to talk to because it is technically a dead language. And then most of the people that are trying to learn it live so far apart that they communicate on a Facebook page. But then again, you're not living and breathing the language. You're just writing it. And so it's
like it's a hobby on the side or something.
Yes. Yeah. So, I think, and I don't feel like I know enough about linguistics in general sometimes to like actually bring it back to life. Like I need to go get another degree or something.
Your signs, though, it is interesting to me that you've created signs that are out in the world that people see in the language, hoping to, if not revive the language itself, at least revive the knowledge that it exists or maybe existed, depending on how you see that.
Yes, and I'm hoping that it does spark some curiosity in people that live in the area and they want to investigate, you know, how do I say stop, nastane, and they are curious about it. So if nothing else, hopefully sparking the curiosity to learn more about the language.
But it's not just, the signs don't just say stop. What does your favorite sign say?
So in addition to the stop sign project, I also invited community members to make bumper stickers. So it was also a community engaged project. So in addition to all of the signage that was installed, I made flyers that invited community members to write sentences that they would envision on a bumper sticker. But they had to do the work themselves using those resources, the online dictionary, the YouTube videos, the study guides, in order to come up with the phrases. So that was the second part of the project. And those were the ones that were very interesting to hear what people came up with.
Were they serious? Were they funny? Like,
there was a bit of both. Some of them just said things like Bahoje Nyeki, which means I am Iowa. Other people said, let's see. My favorite one was Hanashtan Nyeki. Oh, it's Minke Rut Anyeda Hanashtan Nyeki. I break for raccoons was my favorite one. But there were other ones like Hamwe Jade Wakanda Etowe, which means today is the Lord's Day.
You know, you're on our show today because you are one of the first people to participate in this new Indigenous Arts Initiative. It's there to give young Native American artists support and mentorship so that they can forge careers in the arts. What are your thoughts about like what you hoped to gain from this program? Why you applied?
I applied to the program on the visual arts side. They had already established the mentor, so you're applying to work with someone that was already established. On the visual arts side, it was Stephen Grounds, who is a muralist and street artist. And I had recently got a grant to do a community mural in White Cloud, Kansas, with two other tribal members. So I was interested in learning. I had never done a mural before applying for this grant. I had worked with Dave Lowenstein, who is a muralist based in Lawrence, Kansas, a little bit. So I was really interested in learning more about the mural process from someone else, from an Indigenous person, to see how they approach mural making.
So it was the specific mentor they had put in place who really made you think, yeah, I can learn from this person.
Yes.
Is there a sense in which you feel like this kind of program needs to exist? Just beyond this particular mentor and what you particularly can gain from his knowledge.
I mean, I think anything that's supporting the arts is fantastic and does give you a boost because it's another, you know, it's another thing you've been involved in and it gets your name out more. And I mean, especially this mentorship program, working with someone that's already more established and making those connections and the networking that was involved was especially important. And Lawrence is such a great place, especially for something like the Indigenous Arts Initiative, because there's a large Native presence in Lawrence, especially compared to what I was used to living in Missouri, where there's no Natives at all. Haskell Indian Nations University is in Lawrence, and we got to do a lot of joint programs with them and KU through the Indigenous Arts Initiative. So we're meeting students all over, talking about our work, doing panel discussions, and going to film screenings.
When I hear you talk about the projects you've worked on, I can't help but wonder if there is a feeling that you have that being an artist is about more than just you and your work, that it's about progress in a bigger sense.
What I came to discover, I think, through school and through that questioning of what does it mean to be Native is, for me and my personal journey, it was giving back to my tribal community in some way, in whichever way that I am able to do that. So that was really, really important. I kind of have two bodies of work, one of which is specifically for my Native community, doing things like the revitalization of the language or arts programs on the reservation or with tribal members off the reservation. But then I also have other projects that are more about education and talking to non-Natives about the diversity that exists in Native country and in Indian country today. There's 573 plus tribes within the United States. But again, we see that same image of the feathered and fringed Indian from my every Indian costume with a white background piece.
Yeah, not a lot of variety in there, despite
you're
hearing 500
plus
cultures.
The actual diversity, that exists. So,
does that diversity, where do you feel that you fit within that?
I feel like I'm a city Indian, I guess is what they call it. You're kind of disconnected from your culture, but there's a whole history that explains kind of why that happened. And just trying to find those roots. And I think being Native is all about being a walking contradiction. So it's hard to try to find your place, and it's all a journey. And I'm still walking that journey and trying to figure it out. But I do feel a lot more confident in my identity as I get older. And I'm doing these projects and exploring different aspects of my own history and my family history and then also my tribal community.
Your own history, your own personal story is in so many ways the argument for the need for the work like you're doing to exist, that in some ways could the audience that you're speaking to be the young you?
Oh, if I had someone to tell me these things when I was younger, I think I probably would have had an easier time, yes. I think there's a lot of books that I've read since that have really, really helped me come into my own identity.
In your art, I mean, I want to get back to the objects you do tend to find in thrift stores or the images of Indian costumes that you find online and your fascination with those. As more and more imagery hopefully comes from within Native communities, plural, and from people with a whole complex range of experience like your own, What do you see as the significance of these artifacts? They're obviously dated. They're obviously confusing. They're obviously, in some way, pretty annoying for you. But they do tell a story, and one that you are actively there, like, telling. You aren't throwing these objects in the trash. You're putting them in your art.
Yeah, and that's something that I've struggled with as well. Like, why do I collect these things? Why am I so fascinated with them? And then also finding humor in some of them is really important. Some of the things are just so absolutely ridiculous. You have to laugh at them.
Can you give an example?
Oh, I have a whole set of Smurfs that are dressed like Indians that are really funny.
To be fair, there are also, I also feel misrepresented by the little blue people.
Yeah. if you go to some of the descriptions of the Halloween costumes, that's when it gets really, really bad. Talking about, you know, I can't even.
You'd rather not
think,
say.
Yeah, I can't even think of some of them, but they're so just over the top and awful. And but I think a lot of my research started with a blog that I was following in 2011, and it still continues today, called Native Appropriations by Dr. Adrienne Keene. And she would just collect all of these objects digitally and try to talk through them and why some of them were problematic, whether it's the headdresses that Victoria's Secret models are wearing or Navajo-inspired panties, other, like, strange objects that we would find that have something to do with Native culture, but not really,
you know, you,
or in a problematic way.
You mentioned that you spent your weekend finalizing the design for this community mural in White Cloud, and that, you know, this is the project that you're working on through this Indigenous Arts Initiative. Can you tell me about this mural, what you hope for it, and what happened over the weekend?
Yeah, I was really, I mean, in graduate school, this kind of shift in my work happened where I was doing all of these Native mascots are bad, everything's bad, and I wanted to do something more positive. So I started making the shift in my work to bring positive change about in different ways. So one of the projects was this community mural, because I wanted to invite members of the community together to paint something that was a reflection of the community and get their input into what they would like to see in the mural. We just wanted to, like, there's a movement to revitalize the town of White Cloud, which is named after one of our tribal chiefs, and it's the town that's the closest to the reservation.
What is it about it that needs revitalizing? Can you describe that?
So White Cloud is in the ghost towns of Kansas, like, official book. And Deb Bryan, who's one of the tribal members I applied for the grant with, really wants to get the name, to get White Cloud out of that book. We want to bring it back. Every storefront is basically boarded up and closed, but it is a really neat town with a lot of history, and it's just a day trip away from, like, Kansas City or Lawrence.
What is neat about it?
There's, it's a river port town, so there's a lot of great scenery up there. There's a four-state lookout, so if you go to the top of this hill where there's a lookout point, you can see Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, and Iowa, which is really awesome. Of course, there's the reservation really close, so you could come buy some of our tribe's honey from our stores. There's other things that our tribe supports on the reservation as well. There is the story of the piggy bank actually originated in White Cloud, Kansas, which is pretty neat.
What is the story of the piggy bank?
So there was a man in the early 1900s that was raising money for leprosy, and he was trying to raise so much money from each family. And this little boy was really upset because his family, and his name was Pete, the pig, or Wilbur. He was really upset that his family didn't quite raise enough money. But what he ended up doing is buying a pig from market for like a dollar, fattening it up, and then selling it at market, and then he was able to raise the rest of the money for his family to contribute to this leprosy foundation.
Ah, put the money in the pig.
Yep. So then when someone in New York found out about this story, they started producing leprosy mission piggy banks. And those were the first piggy banks.
And they come from White Cloud.
Now
we're back to White Cloud where you're working on this mural. What did you decide over the weekend? You had to finalize the design?
We finalized the design. We had to come up with a smaller design team. So there was just three of us that met and kind of finalized the imagery that we wanted in the mural. So it's different markers from the community, like the lookout, and there's a schoolhouse that's now at the Mahushka Museum that is in White Cloud. So we have that in the mural. We have a Paper Moon, which was a film, was filmed in White Cloud. So that's a part of our mural. So we were just finalizing where all of these pieces were going to live, and it'll be hopefully painted by the end of the month.
Sydney Purcell, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Sydney is one of the first artists to participate in the Indigenous Arts Initiative through KU and the Kansas Creative Arts Industries Commission. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now that everyone is talking about Game of Thrones, GOT for short, a KU grad who worked on it is going to talk to us about what it means to make it behind the scenes in Hollywood. That's next. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're joined by Grant Babbitt. He studied film at KU, and now he's living the dream, working behind the scenes on cinematography for TV shows and movies. His current claim to fame is Game of Thrones, not too shabby. But the path has not been easy. At times, it's been downright uncomfortable. So Grant's other big project is to make that path a little easier for Kansas film kids trying to make it in LA. Hi, Grant.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm wonderful.
So we are going to hear the story of how you basically clawed your way into this industry. But first, for people out there who watch Game of Thrones, can you talk a little bit about your role in making that show look the way it does?
Absolutely. For me, I like to think of it as it's a very small role. It's one of the things that I actually didn't know I had that role for a while. It's kind of a funny story. The whole show is shot over in Europe. So you're not doing a lot of stuff in LA or anything like that. But what happens is it comes back from Europe and all the visual effects are done here in Los Angeles. So I was working, I think, in between season one and season two. I had heard of this show called Game of Thrones. I didn't really know what it was. I just went, okay, whatever. I'm working. That's fine. And my job was to go to where they were doing the visual effects. And when you see the things like the HBO Inside the Look and after the episode where they talk about what they're doing, that's the kind of stuff I was working for. And I was doing that for HBO. And I remember distinctly going and hearing these guys talk about dragons and talk about all these visual effects techniques they were doing. And I remember sitting in front of a giant monitor and seeing this one little guy in a big thing of snow. And I remember the guy talking to me and saying, hey, isn't this so cool? This is coming over from Ireland right now. It's like, they just shot it and now it's here. I was like, cool, that's neat, like, great. I don't know what, like, the technology part of it was really cool, but I didn't understand what was so neat about it. Fast forward, I started watching the show when it was in its fourth season. So I didn't really even know what it was. I had just heard people talk about how great it was. And I go back and I watch the first season. I said, wow, this is amazing. I can't believe like how great this show is. Start watching season two, and all of a sudden there's this shot of a guy in a snowstorm, and it looks so familiar to me, and I could not figure out what it was. Well, turns out it was Jon Snow on the other side of the wall, and it turns out I went back on my call sheets and realized that I actually worked and done a bunch of promotional stuff for the show that I didn't even know I was a part of. So it's funny because I didn't know I worked on the show, and now it's literally one of my favorite shows of all time.
And you realized that watching the show?
Absolutely. I didn't know until I was sitting at home and I had, just saw this shot and I went, that looks so familiar. I don't know why.
A friend of mine posted to Facebook last night that she was at a dinner party and had no idea what anyone was talking about because she hadn't watched Game of Thrones. How does that feel to be part of something that indispensable in the cultural moment?
Well, I will say it is very, I feel like I had a very small part in it. Because there's so many people that it takes to do so many productions. I mean, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people. I mean, there's tons of people that I clearly have never met. You know, I've never been on set with the show, but being there with the people doing visual effects at the time, again, I had no idea what it was. I just thought it was just another work day, you know, a few work days there. Now looking back, I go, oh, wow, that was so cool to be a part of something that's so huge.
I want to back up because having the opportunity to be a part of something like that, even if you don't realize what a big deal it is while it's happening, you know, that opportunity doesn't just fall into your lap. And right. I understand that you moved to LA from Kansas essentially with nothing, not even connections. Is that right?
I would say slim connections, but definitely no money. I had enough money to get out and pay the first month's rent, and then I, you know, went from there. But as far as connections, I didn't, you know, there's no family out here. What I did is when I was a senior at KU, we had this little trip, which was our senior trip, that I think about nine of us tried out for, and we made the trip to LA, and I had never been to LA before. And it was that moment where, you know, LA is this big, scary, intimidating place where then you go there and you meet some people that happen to be some KU alumni that were living out there. And there's a group called the Hollywood Hawks. That's kind of what sponsors us. They put on this trip that the students get to do every year, and they come out during spring break. Well, I was one of the first groups to do that. So, you know, seeing LA for the first time and kind of seeing and meeting other people that had been from Kansas that have made that move and that have seen it's possible. I immediately, when I got home, my first thought was, okay, I'm packing up and I'm going. And that's kind of what it was. I think I went out with one of my closest friends. We went out and lived as roommates, and my girlfriend, who now is my wife, we all three of us lived in an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment, and moved out there and scraped by and tried to make it as much as we could when we first got out here.
When you think about that time period, do you remember it as a struggle, or do you remember it fondly, or some combination of the two?
I could say I could look back now and say it's fondly, yeah, but it's very difficult. I mean, it was a very difficult transition. I didn't have enough money to really, I paid one month's rent, and then I didn't know what to do. So for me, I remember coming out and writing about 90 emails to different production companies and, you know, Craigslist ads and whatever else, just trying to find some scrap of work. And I remember out of 90 emails, I got three responses. Two of them said, hey, you know, come work for free. And the other one said, well, you can come be a stage manager, but it's not really what you're looking for. And so I said, okay, I gotta, like, I have to go do this because I don't have any work. So, to say that it's a struggle, absolutely. And I think no matter how long you've been here, I think it's still a struggle. And that's one thing that people don't really realize, that it always ebbs and flows no matter what.
Can I just back up and ask if you remember falling in love with images on screens and what they could do? Like, I mean, I wonder what TV shows and movies meant to you growing up.
Yeah, well, you know, what's funny is when I was young, I mean, I'm still guilty of this. I was a film major, and I love watching movies. But the one thing that I really fell in love with was watching sports. And so I missed a lot of movies because I was watching sports so much. But name any sports movie and I've seen it. Name any comedy movie, I've seen it. I mean, those were the things that I was really in love with, was, you know, anything that made me laugh, I would watch over and over again. But I distinctly remember the moment that I decided I wanted to go into this industry, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but I was in sixth grade. I went to Chris McAuliffe Elementary School, and my teacher was Miss Kuechel, and she was fantastic. And I think what happened is they had a space skit, and where our school was all, you know, revolved around space because it was Krista McAuliffe Elementary School. And I think what she did is she asked if anybody knew how to run a camera for a skit. And what I did is I raised my hand and I said, yeah, of course I do. And really, I had no idea how to run the camera. But I learned that's a very, very useful skill in the industry. You know, I would step forward and I put my eye in the eyepiece, and I looked at the image and I just went, wow, this is awesome. And I think from that moment on, you know, that was in sixth grade, and went on to do 4 years of video stuff in high school, and then went to college, and then, you know, here I am. And it's something that I fell in love with at a young age.
You fell in love with putting your eye behind the camera.
Absolutely.
Were you at all disappointed when you realized what a climb it was going to be to get the kind of work you wanted?
Oh, no. I've been with my wife for the past 11 years now. It's been a while. But when I was in college, I tried to let her know, hey, I'm a filmmaker, so just know we will always be broke. Like, it's you know, we're an artist. You're a struggling artist. And that was one of those things where, you know, I was preempted that it will be a struggle. And I've accepted it. And the trick is to be able to grow that thick skin so you can push through it. Because, you know, if it's a thing you really love, which I do, I really love doing it. And I can't picture myself doing anything else. So when I think of that, yeah, it's a struggle. And yes, I moved 5 states away from my family and I miss them very much. But ultimately, you know, this is what I signed up for. And so the struggle is part of it. It just comes with the territory.
Do you have a favorite career moment so far? You've worked, because we've talked about Game of Thrones. We haven't talked about the other projects on your resume. You've worked on the Lego movie. You've worked on Ready Player One. Is there just a great moment that you've gotten to experience by being in the career you're in?
Gosh, you know, there's probably many moments. I know a great moment. I mean, I got to work for, you know, like you said, on Ready Player One. My first job ever working with motion capture visual effects was on Ready Player One. So my very first movie attempting this thing that I had never learned how to do before was on a Steven Spielberg movie. So I remember distinctly being in a room with Steven Spielberg and, you know, 4 or 5 other people that have been doing this for years and years and years, and just thinking, why am I here? But also thinking, this is so awesome that I get to do this.
Experiences
like that. Right, exactly. Yeah, I've worked for Rob Reiner as his director of photography on some videos recently that, you know, it was one of those moments where I felt this is really important. I mean, Rob Reiner was the director, and he hired me to come be the director of photography for it. And so I went to his childhood home, which is Carl Reiner's house, and shot with Carl Reiner in his living room with, you know, Rob Reiner there. And then when we got done, he asked me if I wanted to see pictures of Rob as a 3-year-old. And, you know, the answer is, of course I will. You know, there's moments like that oddly happen a lot. I just shot with Bob Newhart last Tuesday, and just meeting him and getting to talk to him for a little bit was just, you know, things you don't get to normally do when you're not in this industry.
So if you, I understand that you are trying to make LA hospitable for young KU grads like you mm-hmm. once were. Do you tell them, send the 90 emails, go take the one job you get out of that, no matter what it is? Do you share those kinds of stories and encourage them to take the same path you did? Or do you have wisdom of how that could have been perhaps easier?
Well, you know, I'd like to say that I have wisdom, but there's so many paths that there's no real correct path. For instance, my, you know, real close friend that moved out here, we moved out here together. Just one example I give the students is I had no money. I came out and I had to scrape and scrap and all this kind of stuff. My friend had some money saved up so he could actually go to the place he wanted to work at, and he could hang out there until they hired him as a production assistant. And now he's, you know, he's head of 2D compositing. So all the stuff that you're seeing on TV, he's in charge of all that stuff. And that he's been at the same job the whole time he's been in LA. So for me, the advice, you know, is always try to save money before you come out as much as you can, because that's helpful. But the 3 rules I try to kind of live by and I share with the kids that are coming up is, you know, one is always show up on time. And, you know, if your call time is 6 a.m., don't be showing up in the parking lot at 6 a.m. You got to be in the parking lot, you know, at 5:45 or 5:30, and then walking in and be ready and be at your camera wherever you need to be at 6 a.m. I will tell you, that's the one that's the hardest for me, but that's the rule one to live by. Number two, be fairly competent of your job, right? For instance, Ready Player One, I had never done motion capture before, but when I, you know, the whole reason I got that job is, oddly enough, a friend from high school from back at Shy Mission West, a friend from high school was working on the movie and asked if I was familiar with the project or how to do these things. And I said, no. And I remember his response was, you know how to run a camera. Don't worry about it. You'll figure it out. And so, you know, being fairly competent about your job, you don't have to be the best, but if you're around people that you like and they can trust you, that's worth, you know, more than gold.
If they can trust you at what you do already now.
Yeah. They trust you at what you can do and trust you as a person, knowing that, you know, whenever you get on set, you're working for essentially people you don't know a lot of times. So if you're recommended by somebody, you represent that person that recommended you. So
okay.
You have to be on your game at all times to be able to, you know, be trustful for those people that put you there.
Tip 3.
Tip three. I'll make it PG. Don't be a jerk. I usually say a different word, but the whole point of it is don't be a jerk to anyone, because really, if you think about it, whether you're driving to work and you cut somebody off and you get on set, turns out that's the producer, right? Or whether someone says, hey, I don't really like your work, and you flip out and say, I can't stand them. The whole point is, you know, you're going to get fired. You're going to get fired. People are not going to like the things you do, and people will like the things you do. It's kind of like this industry sometimes is like reading YouTube comments, right? You can't really take them fully too serious. If someone says you're terrible, you can brush it off. If someone says you're great, you go, okay, thanks, but, you know, I know where I am. And you kind of have to find this level head area where, you know, you're just kind of treating people like you'd want to be treated. And ultimately that all factors into people want to be around you. And we're spending 17 hours together on set a lot of times. So if you're a jerk, if you're not being kind to someone, or if you're going to talk behind their back, it's something that people aren't going to want to work with you anymore.
Are you, what inspired you to hook up with, what is the group called again?
It's a Hollywood Hawks.
Hollywood Hawks. That there's this presence in LA of sort of not quite a safety net. It's more just it's like you're the welcome wagon for KU film grads.
Yeah, it's amazing to be, first of all, to be a part of it from a student that got to see it from that side and experience what this group is able to do, and to now be someone that is a part of the group and reaching out to students and saying, hey, come on, I had this same experience. Why don't you come with me and I'll help you as much as I can? Because, you know, we don't have family out here, a lot of us. A lot of us are from the Midwest. So when you come out here and you know, these people that we meet and these people that we, you know, we share a common bond with, which is, you know, the state of Kansas or KU or Midwest or whatever it is, that becomes kind of your core family out here. And you have to lean on one another constantly.
When you see someone like Kevin Wilmott working in film from Kansas, mm-hmm. creating the kind of career that he has built mostly in Kansas. He lived away, but he came back and he's achieved his greatest success here in the Midwest. Is that something that gets wheels turning in your head about what LA means in film, what Kansas means in film?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I ran into Kevin right before he won his Oscar. I was, oddly enough, shooting a red carpet event for the Critics' Choice Award. And, you know, we waved at each other and he came over and talked. And, you know, it was a great moment just to see Kevin again and say, hey, how are you? And, you know, we're both saying how proud we are of each other. And, you know, it is one of those things that, you know, I've heard about how the Kansas City Film Commission is growing and how there's more projects that are coming back. And, you know, I know like Queer Eye came back and they were shooting and, you know, it's great. I mean, part of me has thought LA is definitely like a hotbed place for work. But man, there's been lots of times where I've thought, you know, Kansas City's growing again with the way it's film stuff. So maybe it would be, if I ever decided to move closer to home, maybe there's a chance to still work on a lot of stuff. Now it's hard for me now though, because I've been out here for almost 8 years. So I've, you know, been trying to plant roots and do these things. So, you know, it's all about connections and who you know. So the longer you're out here, the more connections you get. But yeah, seeing what Kevin's been able to do, knowing people that are back in Kansas City, they're doing some of the things they're doing it makes me proud to be a Kansan. But it also just, you know, it gives me hope that there's lots of people out there that are really talented and they're actually getting a chance to show their talents.
Before you go, will you tell us how the Lego movie works? Just a small question. How does it work?
Well, I don't know exactly how the Lego movie works. I worked on a lot of promotional stuff for it. So that's kind of a lot of my bread and butter. But I will tell you, the Phil and Lord, the two guys that run it, are two of the kindest, funniest guys you'll ever meet. And, you know, it's just great to be a part of something that I love and I can sit with my kids and watch.
That's so cool. Well, Grant Babbitt, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Grant is a KU film alum whose cinematography credits include Game of Thrones, which everyone is talking about, and he wants to help more Kansas kids have a shot at projects like that if they go to LA after they're done with school. That's a wrap. You can listen back to anything from this morning's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, what did Mark Twain eat and who owns the moon? Some few small questions to be discussed tomorrow at 10 on KCUR Central Standard. Between now and then, talk to us on Twitter. We'd love to chat you up. We are at KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so stick around.